Welcome to The Patriot, 1776. Hi, this is John Mady, and I am the pastor of Victory Baptist Church in North Fort Myers, Florida. And who is the Patriot of 1776? You are, and I am, and so is everyone who loves America and wants to follow the principles of our founding fathers. The last sentence of the Declaration of Independence reads like this: "And for the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor." If it had not been for the Patriots of 1776, we would still be paying taxes to England and drinking a spot of tea at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Help us win back America now, just like the Patriots of 1776 won America in the first place. You should take notes and use your Bible. We will give you our mailing address later. Today we're going to start out with Oliver Wendell Holmes. And if we have some time left over, I'm not sure how long that will take, but if we have some time left over, then we're going to begin on Margaret Sanger. And she plays an important part in the history of the United States and in going in the wrong direction. And so let's get started with Oliver Wendell Holmes. And we said last time that we would be talking about Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. and the natural law. Natural law being God's law. Quote, "Among the many justices who have sat on the United States Supreme Court, Oliver Wendell Holmes stands out for his enduring influence on the court's jurisprudence. Among his many accomplishments as a member of the court was to help eradicate judicial reasoning based on principles of natural law or natural right. Hence his thoughts is of great importance to any study of the history of natural law theory in American constitutional history. Holmes' understanding of legal realism shows his relationship to the natural law and natural rights traditions. For Holmes, law and society are always in flux, and courts adjudicate with an eye to law's practical effects. Morality has nothing to do with law. It amounts to little more than a state of mind. There are no objective standards for determining right and wrong, therefore, no simple just answers to legal questions. Legal adjudication has no natural or even constitutional basis. Instead, it comes down to weighing questions of social advantage according to the exegeses of the age. Holmes thus raises squarely a fundamental question. If the Constitution does not dictate anything that is not time-bound, is there any ground for faith in the Constitution or liberal constitutionalism? The latter would seem to require an understanding that only promulgated the known laws, which meaning is stable over time to bind citizens. Yet, Holmesian legal realism denies the very possibility of such laws. Holmes was heir to an exponent of intellectual doctrines that predated his tenure on the court and which were offshoots of the new scientific attitudes toward politics and human affairs. After the Civil War, pragmatism and social Darwinism came to dominate the American intellectual landscape, sweeping away all notions of natural law and natural rights, and a constitutionalism dedicated to their defense. For both the pragmatists and social Darwinists, life and thought are directed to continuous change and adoption to the free environment. The test of the worthiness of any proposition is not its truth in and of itself, the standard of natural law theory, but its adoptive success, survival of the fittest, which is the engine of progress. Although Holmes often depicted as an advocate of judicial restraint, he oftentimes saw the need for courts to provide the creative responses dictated by the times. As Holmes dismisses natural law, his jurisprudence as the science of positive law becomes merely a predictive tool along the lines of modern science. Well-trained lawyers, according to Holmes, became the oracles of the new legalism and indeed new constitutionalism. Under his definition of truth is that which is helpful or useful here and now, it is beyond lawyers' abilities, as it is beyond the ability of anyone to point to the constitutional truth of things. To know legal dogma is to be able to make predictions. People want to know under what circumstances and how far they will run the risk of coming against what is so much stronger than themselves, and hence it becomes a business to find out when this danger is to be feared. The object of our study, then, is prediction, the prediction of the incidence of public force through the instrumentality of the courts. This is far from Plato's notion in the Minos that law seeks to be a discovery of what is, or Aquinas's that proper human law must not conflict with the natural law, which is accessible to unaided human reason, or to the American founders' written constitutionalism. In what terms are we to understand what law's instrumentability is? The courts will actually do. Holmes claims that law reflects not logic, but experience. Law cannot be understood by the syllogistic, that is, the major premise of sound legal analysis being found in the law itself. The minor premise in the facts of the case, such analysis implies judges can decide particular case on the basis of right reason. And so they're just making up their own law. Judges look to history and incorporate science, especially economic science, into their jurisprudence. Holmes' social Darwinism exhibited in his view that views express the wishes of their class at a particular historical point, albeit this view is in clear tension with his view that judges must decide cases fairly. The content and growth of law are determined as much by organic forces as by men. The actual grounds of decision, according to Holmes, are based on the felt necessities of the time. Judges decide questions first and find reasons for them ex post facto. There can thus be no logical socioeconomic advantage. Holmes maintains that one of the problems of the common law prior to legal realism was that it had not been, in a certain sense, theoretical enough, that is, not reliant enough on the social and economic theory, as opposed to insight into eternal questions of justice. In fact, the judge gives his conclusions because of some belief as to the practice of the community or of a class, or because of some opinion as to the policy. Such matters really are battlegrounds where the means do not exist for determinations that shall be good for all time, or where the decision can do no more than embody the preference of a given body in a given time and place. Our law is open to reconsideration upon a slight change in the habit of the public mind. No concrete proposition is self-evident. In other words, unquote here, it all depends on how you feel at the time. It just depends on how things are going. It doesn't depend on law. Law is just there to kind of look at. But law needs to be just like what the Bible is. It never changes. And so this is what godless people want to do. They want to change the law. They want to have it to be what what they feel is right. And so when you pass laws, they're changing laws. That's why the liberals and the Democrats don't like the Constitution, because the Constitution is a steady law. And that's why the liberals don't like the Bible, because the Bible is a set of laws that never changes. All right, let's go on. The core of Holmes' legal realism, its pragmatism, along with a confidence in or grim acceptance of the progress of history, is brought into relief by examining its insistence on the notion that courts must interpret and balance rights. The importance of this weighted judicial balancing is nowhere more evident than in Holmes' free speech jurisdiction. In Schenck v. United States, Holmes stated that the famous clear and present danger test, as a pragmatist doctrine that avoided inquiry into the content, that is, the nature of speech, and concentrated only on its likely effects. Prior to the articulation of this doctrine, the content of speech was considered of vital constitutional import. In Abrams v. United States, decided just months after Schenck, a majority of the court upheld the convictions of anti-government, anti-war radicals who advocated violence. Holmes dissented on the basis of his clear and present danger test. According to Holmes, free speech fosters free trade in ideas, and the interest of truth is in its abilities to get accepted in the marketplace of ideas, which will happen when the market accesses its needs. Implicit in this is a genuine Darwinian confidence that society need not fear that which triumphs. The beliefs that will triumph in the long run are critical, not the constitutional or regime beliefs that have existed up to the present, much less a natural law that is not time-bound. For Holmes, rights are willed by the dominant forces of an age and community. Whatever prevails is right, and therefore all political developments are good until they are no longer in ascendancy, and every regime is worthy until it is overthrown or crumbles. Judges themselves, as well as legislators, must to some large degree reflect dominant forces according to the state's position in history. Understand not that a mere record of events, but as a process that dictates its own moral categories. Holmes was therefore a progressive in the historical sense, rather than in his individual rights, which could favor repressive law as well as progressive law. Holmes' thought can be said to reduce to a new natural law, a Darwinian process of triumph over lesser forms, or progressivism as a legal theory. And close quote there. Just to make mention, to remind us all that natural law is what comes from God. God gives us natural laws. And when we talk about social Darwinism or Darwinian process at all, we're talking about things made up without God. Okay, let's go on. And one more thing. When he says that to some large degree it reflects dominant forces according to the state's position in history. In other words, what Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. is doing is he's just making it up as he goes along. He says, here's the law, but because of the times that we live in, it should be like this. Therefore, we'll follow this. My own thinking. In Gitlow versus New York, Holmes made an arresting claim. If in the long run the beliefs expressed in the proletariat dictatorship are destined to be accepted by the dominant forces of the community, the only meaning of free speech is that they should be given their chance and have their way. But if the Constitution is itself neutral or indifferent on this question, what is the basis for a constitutional ruling in favor of a First Amendment claim? Again, we are led to Darwinian experimentalism, albeit of a foreboding, fatalistic kind. Holmes was often willing to show great deference to legislative judgments as the sovereign expressions of popular will. In Lochner versus New York, Holmes dissented on the grounds of constitutional neutrality from a majority that held that the state economic regulations limiting work hours were unconstitutional. He famously claimed, "I strongly believe that my agreement or disagreement has nothing to do with the right of the majority to embody their opinion in law. I think the word of liberty in the 14th Amendment is perverted when it is held to prevent the natural outcome of a dominant opinion." But this modest conception of the judicial function in a democracy was not Holmes' final word. Holmes' jurisprudence, when it limits economic freedom, for Holmes, survival or progress might require activism or restraint, and reliance on either is purely an instrumental or experimental question. Holmes' notable claims, "When I say that a thing is true, I mean that I cannot help believing it. But as there are many things that I cannot help doing that the universe can, I do not venture to assume that my inabilities in the way of thought are inabilities of the universe. I therefore divine the truth as the system of my limitations." Even more radically, Holmes' efforts to debunk this philosopher's quest for absolute truth, or the jurist's for natural law, led him to suspect that the morality of even the greatest human struggles depends entirely on the outcome. "I used to say when I was young that truth was the majority vote of that nation that could lick all others. Certainly we may expect that we received opinion about the First World War will depend a good deal upon which side wins. I hope with all my soul it will be mine, and I think that the statement was incorrect insofar as it implied that our test of truth is a reference to either a present or an imagined future majority in favor of our view." This account of natural law paints it as nothing more than a dominant opinion. And supports of such dominant opinions. Racial improvement through eugenics was one outgrowth of early century progressivism. And unquote. I'd like to just make a mention of something here. The next person that we're going to talk about that has affected our country is just about that. It talks about eugenics, and as a matter of fact, the first thing that we're going to do when we talk about the next person is to talk about the definition of eugenics. And notice that it's an outgrowth of early 20th century progressivism. And progressivism is that form of government which you kind of make up as you go along, and it is a government that is done without God. So let me just read that sentence over again, and then we'll go on. Okay, quote, "Racial improvement through eugenics was one outgrowth of early 20th century progressivism, possessing as it did considerable faith in the ability of science and purportedly scientific administration to solve social problems. In one of the most notorious judgments, Holmes wrote the 8-1 majority opinion of Buck versus Bell that upheld a Virginia compulsory sterilization law. Holmes upheld that the law on the grounds that those targeted by the law were treated with scrupulous procedural fairness. Decrying those who sap the strength of society and contending in reference to the affected litigant and her family that three generations of imbeciles are enough. Holmes seemed to accept the eugenic arguments to the point of endorsing them on grounds of public policy. Holmes reasoned by analogy. He compared the hardships of sterilization with the sacrifices of soldiers in battles. Referring to the Civil War, he argued that if the public welfare may call upon the best citizens for their lives, surely those who sap the strength of the state should be called upon for a lesser sacrifice. In his rejection of natural law and natural rights, and with it a liberal constitutionalism of limited state power, Holmes laid the groundwork for the contemporary era of jurisprudence, where judges came to look at their visions of the future more than to documents and doctrines of the past, and thus to take on a new and far more active role in the constitutional order. Closed quote. Now that's the end of what we'll be looking at for Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr., but I'd like to make some comments concerning this. First of all, when liberals and Democrats and socialists and progressives and communists, when they talk about our Constitution as being a living, breathing document, what they mean is just what Oliver Wendell Holmes thinks about it, and that is that that is just fine to have the Constitution, but we need to understand that things that were written in the Constitution 150 years, 200 years ago, Holmes is writing these things around 1930, so you have 1830 back to 1776. So it's about 150 years plus before him, 154 years. And so he's saying that what's going on right now does not match what was going on 154 years ago. So what we have to do is just kind of tweak the Constitution to make it fit for today. So it's a living, breathing document. You can change the meaning of the Constitution to mean the things that we want it to mean for today. And so that's the same thing as saying that all that is in God's Word is okay for those people 2,000 years ago, but we have to understand that we've progressed past God's thinking 2,000 years ago, and now what we have to do is we need to bring up to date what man has learned since God told us those things 2,000 years ago, and just correct God's thinking on these things. Now, that's what Oliver Wendell Holmes is saying. That's what socialists are saying. That's what communists are saying. That's what liberals and Democrat Party what else can we, who else can we throw in there? Progressives. That's what those people are saying. In other words, the laws don't really mean anything because we can change them as time goes by to fit the particular day. They can kind of make the laws anything that they want to. Now, the next thing that we're going to do is to talk about something that's very important to all of us. And the whole thing comes down to something that Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. was involved with, something that this next person that we're going to talk about was involved with, and they all believed in eugenics. They all believed in social Darwinism. They liked to follow Darwinism. And when you follow Darwinism, you can follow people encouraging people to commit suicide. And when you follow social Darwinism, you get rid of people that don't add to society. And one of the biggest things that is used today to help with social Darwinism is abortion. And so the next person that we're going to talk about is someone who deals and got started with abortion in America. As a matter of fact, her name is Margaret Sanger. And Margaret Sanger was a very big follower and believer of Darwin's book, The Origin of Species. And don't forget, The Origin of Species was not a book that was solely about biology. The main thrust of The Origin of Species is the fact of the survival of the fittest, which deals with people. And so Margaret Sanger was very much accustomed to following social Darwinism, as are people like Hillary Clinton and those kinds of people of that ilk. And next week, we're going to get started on that. And I think we're going to have a lot of information given to us that we never suspected. The major goal as of 1992 of the Darwin socialists is to get the world population down to 250 million people. So comes the end of today's message. We appreciate so much that you spent time to be with us. If you enjoy our program, would you please take time to send us any questions you might have, along with a love offering of any amount? And if you send at least $25, we will send you a 92-page book, When Good Men Do Nothing, Who Will Speak? Our address is The Patriot, 1776, at 14505 Nathan Hale Lane, North Fort Myers, Florida, 33917. Again, The Patriot, 1776. The address is 14505 Nathan Hale Lane, North Fort Myers, Florida, 33917. Talk to you again next time. Goodbye now.